The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. This program will take you behind the scenes and deepen your understanding about the patterns and perspectives of leadership today. Now, here's your host, John Schmidt.
Well, hello. Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of Zoomed Leadership. I am your host, John Schmidt, and today, as every week, I'll be helping to take us out to the big picture, into the up close and personal, and toward a world of desirable futures, those rich with the essence of constant renewal. It is a great pleasure to be back with you again today. My energy is high, I must say. My attention feels clear, and my focus is really today on three elements of life that I think we should all be paying real and concrete attention to: the economy, energy, and the environment. Because the big picture of these three realms, I think, as our guest will explore with us today, will have increasingly real and, I think, substantial impact on the up-close and personal dimension of our daily lives. I've been talking a lot, as you regular listeners know, over the recent weeks and the last probably 30 overall, that the world is in transition, and under the hood of the big systems that we have been talking about, under the hood of the big vehicle itself, are powerful forces that are shaping the essence of our very tangible lives. And whether you are the beneficiary of the good life through this current system and this way of life in motion, or you are outside it and outside the benefits and unhappy with the realities and the inequities involved, either case, you need to recognize what is really going on. Great change is likely coming. You need to know why. You need to know how. You need to know what actions to take to prepare for it all. So I really want to get right into it today, right into things with our guest joining us again on Zoomed for a continuing conversation on the three E's: energy, economy, and environment. Our show title is Three E's and the New Decade of Awareness, meaning we really want to continue to broaden this and really see how far this has gone and will be going. My guest today, Chris Martinson, and regular listeners know Chris well. He's the author of The Crash Course. I've talked about it many times, probably the best 3 hours of time you can spend, certainly, on this subject. He's a strategic advisor on realities of the big system and what's under the hood, as I'm referring to it, and with the adeptness he has at making this whole system that's complex, how to make it direct and clear and understandable to virtually everyone, and through his ability to connect the dots the way others don't often see, I think he's been a significant contributor to the larger picture. And as a sideline to that, he's been also tapped as a fellow at Post Carbon Institute. And Post Carbon, we have talked about Post Carbon Institute as a real solid assemblage of thought leaders across multiple disciplines and domains that are coming together and I think are bringing the kind of perspective to bear collectively on the transition and on the potential forms that might be emerging, but clearly about the issues at hand. We're getting Chris today just after a gathering of the fellows of with Post Carbon Institute this past weekend in San Francisco here in the U.S. Chris, great to have you back on Zoomed.
John, it's my pleasure to be here.
Maybe we can start, Chris, with a little update on the weekend, kind of the intention, the flow, the focus, just your whole sensation of the weekend. I'm sure it was a pretty intense one.
It was just a wonderful weekend, very sobering, very exciting and uplifting as well. This was a gathering, the first gathering of all the fellows of the Post Carbon Institute in a face-to-face format, and the intent was to get ourselves aligned and really talk about what's the vision, what are we trying to do, how are we going to do it, what's our messages, and how are we going to coordinate and collaborate with and amongst each other, and what we're going to be taking out into the world. And the sobering part for me was to really sit down with world experts on water use and issues, on biodiversity, on ecological footprint, on energy, on all sorts of issues across the social and ecological dimensions, and everybody's got a pretty sobering story to tell, and when you put it into one spot, it becomes really sobering. And the good news is that we've got some really bright, creative, very clever, very articulate people who are bringing their gifts out into the world. And for me personally, this is an exciting development, because I'll be honest, 5 years ago I felt kind of alone. Maybe I just wasn't, you know, hanging out in the right circles, but now, you know, after seeing this level of talent and being able to be part of it is that's the exciting part, because we are headed in the right direction, I can say.
Well, that's great to hear, Chris, and connecting the dots, and we've had a number of folks on, or at least a few folks. Richard Heinberg has been on, Sandra Postel has been on. I was mentioning to you before we got on the show today, Eric Allen will be on. We've been talking about some of these issues. We've been talking about oil, been talking about water, talking about food next week. But putting this together and connecting the dots on them, to me, is one of the distinctive factors of post-carbon that I have really caught my attention as we've been looking at the field here. Really great to hear that you're involved in that.
Yeah, thank you. It's what it all boils down to me at this point is in the direction I'm really looking at this now, is that we just have to really begin to fundamentally change the ideas that are out there in the marketplace, the ideas that are out there in the culture. What are the ideas about who we are and where we're going as a species, as a culture, as a nation? Because, you know, as you mentioned in your intro, this is a transition moment, and we are transitioning from one sort of architecture about how we live in the world, right? We consume resources in ever-increasing amounts year after year, into a different future where perhaps we're much more cognizant of the flow rates of those resources, the fact that maybe not all of them should be dedicated solely to humans. We have to be a lot more like stewards of the resources rather than just simple consumers. And that shift is a shift as much in ideas, it's a shift in the thoughts that we have, as much as it is in any physical reallocation or reorientation of ourselves and the landscape. So it's those two areas that really need to be done, and I think post-carbon is very well situated to really pick up and help us shape the ideas that we need, because I think, honestly, those are the most important. You know, those are the ones that it's, you know, ideas are how humans organize, right? So if a bunch of people get an idea to go out into the desert and create a big, giant festival called Burning Man, it happens. And it happens because the idea was there. And so that's what I really see coming now is this big reshaping of ideas. And that's a big challenge. It's also a really exciting time to be alive.
Well, it's an exciting challenge and a huge need, and it's connecting the dots in so many different disciplines, you know, that you see a couple of connected here and there, but not with all the dimensions of the 14 fellows and the different topical areas that you're really speaking about there. And, Chris, you were working on a vision and strategy. Anything concrete to report out of that? Certainly the direction about the awareness and shifting that, but anything more concrete coming out of that, or is it a little premature yet?
Well, we have plenty of material. That material now needs to be refined. So, you know, we've got pass one, as you know, from doing this sort of work. It's always a big output, and it's difficult at first, and it feels like it's uncertain, and then it coalesces. And so we coalesced at the end, and now we're going to work on and refine what that vision is. And, you know, somebody's got to come out with a message and the vision. And unfortunately, it's not coming, you know, at the highest levels from our government at this point or from corporations. There's some fairly lackluster leadership there in terms of the really big issues. But I can tell you that there's a group of people who've got a very fine vision of where we want to go and what we want the world to look like. And, you know, that's step one. And then step two, we'll figure out how we get there.
Well, that's encouraging. We'll continue to report on that and, you know, bring that to light as we come here and want to do that. So I wanted to really be able to get a picture of that, at least to make that bridge. But as well, Chris, I really wanted to tune into you here today with the nature of the economy, the energy, the environment, what you pull together so well in the Crash Course and make so explicit. And for those that haven't, I really point you to chrismartinson.com, Chris's website, or just Google the Crash Course. We're not going to get into all the background material on that. We've addressed that through some earlier shows in the year, back in May and June. I point you to the Crash Course. It is a fabulous way to get oriented to this, and we're going to pick up on that. But Chris, maybe start us off here, just for those that aren't familiar, just sort of as a broad introduction and to connect the dots on the three E's, just to get us moving. And I'd like to take each one with one of our segments today as we go forward.
Sure. The big story is this. You know, the economy is the way by which we as humans, it's the way we organize ourselves. And every system has pros and cons. Every system enforces some behaviors, punishes others. And this is a moment where if we back way up and we look at our economy and how it's structured, and I'm not passing judgment on it. I'm not going to say it's good or it's bad. I can find elements of both. My job is to just describe it. And we can describe it very simply. We have an economic model, a system, that has to continuously grow in order to function reasonably well, as we would define it. So look at 2009. The world economy shrank, I'm going to guess, somewhere between 3 and 5%. We don't have the final figures, but it shrank a little bit. And my goodness, you would have thought the whole world was about to go up in flames. It behaves very poorly. We could say, at the very least, that's not a resilient economy. It operates very well going forward 3%. It gets thrown into paroxysms of fits of near destruction if it shrinks by 3%. So I can go on and on in all the ways that I can prove to you empirically or mathematically or theoretically that we have an economy and an economic system that has to continuously grow. Well, what's an economy? Well, an economy is taking primary sources of wealth, that's rich soils and concentrated ore bodies and pools of oil, and converting those through into secondary sources of wealth. So we farm the soil and we turn it into food. We take the ore and we refine it into iron. We take the pools of oil and we refine it into gasoline and use it. And on top of those first two primary and secondary sources of wealth, we as humans have these abstract forms of wealth that we sort of slather all over the top of that, tertiary forms of wealth. This is the debt that we use. These are the credit default swaps and all of the other complicated instruments we've been hearing about. But the thing that's really I want to focus on is, rewind, the primary source of wealth is what comes from the earth. Everything else happens because of that. And so as we look at that story and we say, okay, we've got an economy that needs to grow exponentially and it feeds off of primary sources of wealth, this is a good time maybe to step back and ask ourselves, is there anything in that story that might give us pause? Is there something there that would give us a sense that well, there's maybe a trouble in this story somewhere? Well, of all the resources we could possibly talk about, energy is the most important one. Energy is, if you don't have energy, all the money in the world won't make the slightest bit of difference. Energy is what makes the world go round. And of the sources of energy, none has been more important to our economy and its growth and health than oil. And so there's a great story there that we really need to talk about in terms of oil.
That's great, Chris. And that's the connecting the dots. It is that we have to grow, then what is the story on oil? What is the story on energy? And then we'll connect the dots, as I was pointing to in the introduction here, pointing the energy in terms of the resources even more broadly, the broad base of fundamental reality of what we're drawing upon. That's our conversation today. Chris Martinson, our guest, our show title, Three E's and the New Decade of Awareness, Energy, Economy, Environment. Let's take a short break. Listeners, come on back. Join me today. Chris is going to take them one at a time, one segment at a time, and see where we are, where we're heading. Let's update from the view we can get from Chris today. Thanks. Come back in a moment.
When it comes to business,
you'll find the experts here.
Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership? Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8880. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind. Wake up with a unique daily show covering the world of sports with a new perspective. Get Off the Bench with Mitchell John. We'll bring you the current sports news and events happening now, not later like the others. Your first look at sports will feature the news and views from professional, college, and high school sports. Tune in with Mitchell John for a can't-miss program every weekday. Catch Get Off the Bench with Mitchell John weekday mornings at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Sports Channel.
It's all Arizona, all over the world. If you're a local Arizona high school sports fan, or if you're a transplanted fan somewhere else in the world, have we got a show for you. The first internet sports radio talk show focusing solely on high school sports is The Coach's Corner with Scott Lovely. Tune in to talk about your favorite teams, players, or coaches. It's 100% Arizona high school sports coverage and a little bit more. Tune in Mondays at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern, to the Voice America Sports Channel.
Are you ready to take on a new outlook about dating today? Let the secrets of dating and relationship success inspire, inform, and motivate you to find, build, and grow a successful and loving relationship. Host Gloria McDonald has helped over 3,000 couples find love and lasting relationships, and she's ready to give you the wisdom you need to cultivate that perfect relationship. Tune in to the secrets of dating and relationship success with Gloria McDonald every Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoom Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back with Chris Martinson today. Our conversation continues. We're about the awareness of the big system, the vehicle we're living. What's the engine under the hood? How is it working? And how is the fuel holding up? Chris, you were really making some opening comments and connecting the dots some and a broad picture on the economy, the financial system, and energy. Maybe you can continue on that before we go too deeply into the what's going on with the economy itself.
Well, sure. We were just sort of, you know, are talking about and going through one of the big picture things that's coming up. So we know that there's a couple things we know. And we know that peak oil is a reality, whether it's going to happen now or it's already happened to something or it happens in 10 years from now. It's just a geological process. It's not a theory. It's a description of physical reality. And so we know it's coming. And the issue before us there is really no more complicated than the fact that the last 200 years of industrial growth have been intimately linked with growth in energy use. You know, to put this in context, think about this. A 22-year-old alive today, during their lifespan, half of all the oil ever taken out of the ground and burned has been done so in that person's lifespan.
And that's a great visual. That's a great visual, Chris.
I got that from Wes Jackson of the Land Institute, one of the fellows here at PCI this weekend. He was a quote machine. I loved that one. But because it really puts it right into context, right? A 22-year-old has seen half of all the oil ever burned. Well, one of the features of living in an industrial economy, which is the one we live in, and we love it, right? We love the technology. We love the advance, the medical advances we've got. It's just a very wonderful, comfortable life, and I think most of us like to see that continue. But we've got to understand that that came because we had this access to this incredible abundance of concentrated energy, and we've been using it, as the 22-year-old example pulled forward. and at ever-increasing rates. And when we look at the concept of peak oil, we've got on this one hand this notion that the most important substance to our style of life, to our type of economy, to everything that we hold dear, that the most important source of energy for that is going to be peaking relatively soon if it hasn't already. And on the other hand, we can be holding up this view of the economy, which says, whether we look at it theoretically, scientifically, or empirically, that it's an exponential, growth-based economic model. And we put those two pieces together, we smash our two hands together, and we say, there's a collision here, and it's exceedingly difficult to see how we're going to resolve these two by anything other than really highly concentrated, focused, dedicated efforts. But if we ignore it, if we just choose to, you know, go back to status quo and pretend it doesn't exist and then we'll deal with it when it hits us, I think we're going to be finding that that's a future that's really going to be shaped by disaster. And we have the opportunity to shape our future by design. And so this is really where my passion comes out. I'm like, gosh, I'd really hate to default into a future of disaster because we just weren't being very intelligent about this. I think, you know, if we'd like to think of ourselves as a really creative and intelligent species, this would be a good sort of a thing to focus our attention on and prove that that's true. And so it's a really big picture thing. We can see it coming. Even the most optimistic assessments that say peak oil is not going to happen until 2020, you know, that seemed like a lot further away back when it was before it was 2010. Now it's 10 years away. It's an enormous challenge, an enormous set of challenges. If we want to continue forward with the kind of lifestyle that we've been living. And maybe we can't continue it exactly as it is, but certainly we could mitigate and be clever and creative in how we utilize our remaining resources, and we can create any sort of a world we want within some limitations around the world. But one thing that we can't do is to continue to lead exactly the type of lives we've been leading for the past 10, 20, 30 years. And have that work out very well.
And so let's stay on this just for a minute here with the energy piece. We've had Richard Heinberg on, one of the other fellows there in the conversation about oil. Really, the messages I think you're describing, Chris, I think were clear and elucidated. But there's also something here. It's not easy to replace what we're talking about with oil. I mean, any part of that come up into the conversation over the weekend, too? It's not easy to replace it, and I hear an awful lot in the environmental realms talking about all we need to do is easily shift to alternative fuels. But that's not an easy proposition, as I think Richard has been pointing to, has he not?
Well, this is the thing where I just wish that some of the people who talked about how great alternative energy or fuels are going to be had spent some time working in a manufacturing process at some point in their lives. There are issues of time, scale, and cost. They're not insurmountable, but they're also not trivial. And it really, I find it really just challenging to talk with somebody who talks about energy and technology as if it just sort of springs forth from nothing. It takes an enormous amount of effort to make it happen. So, you know, here's an example. Let's imagine right now that we decide, oh, okay, peak oil's real, and we're gonna build carbon fiber cars, electric cars, right? And that's what we'll do. Like, all right, we built less than 1 million of those cars so far, just electric ones, let alone carbon fiber. So I'll grant you that we can build 50 million of these cars tomorrow, and that's all we sell into the marketplace globally. It'll still take 10 years at the replacement rate to get half of those cars replaced in the marketplace. So even if, you know, magically we could snap our fingers and we've got, like, you know, this, we've scaled up this enormous technology, which doesn't exist yet, and we put it out there, it'll still take 10 years. But if things happen like they normally do and we have to first decommission existing factories and we've got to solve issues related to the supply of, I don't know, lithium or whatever these new elements are we're going to need to run these cars, et cetera, it'll be 20 to 30 years. That's a realistic assessment. So we can take that 20 to 30 years just trying to solve transportation around cars and then now map that against what we know about peak oil, and there's a disconnect there. And it's profound, and it has to do with the time, the scale, the cost. So my wish is that the people who do advocate alternative technologies and fuels as potential solutions and replacements, that they at least break out a napkin and a crayon and sketch out the issues around time, scale, and cost in terms of that being a meaningful substitution at the scales we're talking about right now.
And so there's a portfolio of the energy, and there's a portfolio of solutions, and the timing and the scale, these are big issues. So it seems to me this pushes us back where we started, Chris, in that we have an economy, and we'll talk more about this in a minute, that has to grow for reasons that we'll talk about, but can't grow. And that really points back to the oil issue. And you've written some reports recently as well that said, okay, even in this environment and scarce resources and within what you're talking about, that we've got an interesting thing, China, sort of the year of the tiger. We got some realities emerging out of this and the nature of the demand for it and how resources are really being stockpiled of sorts or trying to lock up different supply sources on that. Can you say a little bit about that? Because there's a close-at-hand reality within this larger context, too.
Well, there's a story here. I'm connecting a few dots. Maybe I've got them wrong, but here's what the story looks like to me. If you just go out and Google China resources and then put in a couple countries, Africa, South America, Canada, pick them, Australia, you'll get just an enormous quantity of hits, and most of them are a little bit under the radar screen in the sense that they're just business articles. In Australia, announcing a major coal deal between Rio Tinto and China, between Venezuela and China for an extra 600,000 barrels per day of oil production going to China, between Canada for timber, for tar sands oil output, et cetera. There's just an enormous quantity of stories, and if you put them all together in one spot, there's a potential picture that emerges, and it's this. It looks like somebody out there has figured out that the next couple of decades, the story is about having access to resources and securing that access to those resources. And so when I put all those dots together, it seems entirely probable to me that somebody in China has the same view of the world that I do and many others do, that we can look forward into the future, and even if peak oil wasn't a reality, we can already see the tightening of certain critical resources and even the ending of certain resources that we know about because the ore bodies will be completely tapped and gone. We can look forward and see that coming, and you could imagine a strategy where a country would say, I see it coming, and so what I'm going to do is make sure I have access to those resources. And so that's the story I see going forward out there. I think that China is playing they're in a race, right? They understand that we're in a race to secure access to the remaining resources, and my perception is that, at least publicly, my country isn't even aware that there's a race going on. We haven't even begun to lace up our shoes, and China's already halfway down the track on this one. So this story, though, is really, it just snaps into such clear focus. All you have to do, you can go to the USGS, that's the Geological Service, and you can download a whole bunch of PDF documents, and you can look at our estimates of how much stuff remains out there. Coal, minerals like copper, tin, zinc, silver, you know, whatever these things are. And you can clearly see, within a very reasonable planning amount of time, within a decade or two at most for some of these, you can see the end. But once you put peak oil back on top of that, I think that the estimates of how much of these things we have are actually extremely optimistic, because to get out the last little bit of copper from a hole that's a mile deep in the ground takes an enormous amount of energy. When energy comes into short supply, then you make decisions, right? It's enforced priorities. Are we going to get that last bit of 0.2% copper ore up from a hole a mile deep in the ground, or are we going to grow wheat?
Right, so that's really why you do a great job, Chris, on the crash course, and others are really pointing to the fact that we have to grow and that we have limitations on growth, which you're really pointing to. And I might even add, in terms of not only oil and resources, you do the search on Google, you're going to find the same thing about land and relative to food and growing food, and it's not only coming out of China, other countries are doing the same thing. It's really pointing up to the nature of the scarcity and the resources that support this growth, how they'll be in the demand, but how they can be limiters on that. And I'd like to come back and really, Chris, go into the economy some more and talk more about the drivers that are really driving this. Where are we on this realm of financial and economic system? But let's take a break. Short break here, listeners. We'll come on back. Two more segments. Chris Martinson here. We're continuing to look at the three E's. The decade of awareness needs to infuse our perspective, our understanding for our own business, our organizations, our communities, understanding the nature of our nation and the way we have to shift it. That's part of our dialogue here on Zoomed. Come on back. Take a break. Chris Martinson, again, thanks. Come on back.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership? Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8888. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind. Ask Theo Live is talk radio like you've never heard before. Following her near-death experience, world-renowned author and spiritual medium Sheila Gillette became the direct voice channel for Theo, a consortium of 12 archangels. Through this unique channel, Sheila and her co-host Marcus Gillette present you with an opportunity to speak directly with Theo live on air on any topic you wish to discuss, including receiving authentic messages from deceased loved ones and angelic guides. Get the answer you need by tuning in to Ask Theo Live talk radio. Tuesday mornings at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, 11 a.m. Eastern Time on Seventh Wave Network. Are medical professionals in your life telling you that nothing's wrong with you? Are you interested in learning more about self-healing? Tune in to Self-Healing with Dr. Judy Griffin. In this unique program, we'll explore both age-old traditions and innovative techniques that will help heal your personal environment. From illnesses to personal goals and so much more, Self-Healing is here to guide you. Join us every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time for Self-Healing on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back on Zoom, John Schmidt here, Chris Martinson, our guest. We're talking about the three E's. We've been talking a longer-term horizon here with Chris to get us open. Chris, let's bring it in here a little bit and maybe a shorter-term horizon. I was even noticing this morning looking at Forbes and a February 8th issue with Daniel Fisher. The article is The Global Debt Bomb, and talking some about debts and deficits, money supply, all of that. Maybe give us a sense of what's really been catching your attention in the more near-term kind of horizon.
Well, yeah, so the key question at this point is, I think on a lot of people's minds, is the economy, is it recovering? And if it is, how much of a recovery are we going to have? And what's the shape of the recovery and all of that? And I think most of that's premature. I tend to be very cautious about recoveries, particularly given the fact that one of the things we really have to appreciate in this is that this crisis is not like any other one we can look at historically. Yes, there were individual countries that got into debt problems in the past, and so we can look to those for models around what that might look like in terms of a recovery. And what kind of strategies we might want to pursue to get us out of it. But this was a global credit bubble. Thank you, Alan Greenspan, and his associated central banking friends around the world. They fostered and perpetuated an exponential increase in debt. And, you know, the key thing is people often ask me, how can I understand this crisis easily? And I can make it very simple. For the United States, this is very simple. Between 2000 and 2008, the total credit market debt in this country doubled. 8 years, and we doubled our debt from $26 trillion to $52 trillion. We doubled it. Now, what do we know about debts? Well, you either have to pay them back or you default on them, right? You either pay them back out of your productive economy or you have a debt crisis. And so when we ask the question, was it a good thing or a bad thing that we doubled our debt, the very first thing we'd want to know is, well, tell me about jobs and tell me about wages, because those are the mechanisms by which people will pay those debts back. It turns out that during that same period of time, we had zero net job growth, first decade that we've ever seen that happen, and median wages actually went backwards. So the means to pay those debts back were absolutely being stagnant and flat and going nowhere while the debts were just skyrocketing. And that was what I was focusing on the whole time when I was in my whole period where I was predicting. I was saying, look, we've got a crisis coming. It just couldn't have been more obvious. I think anybody who understands how debts are created and how they get paid back would be able to appreciate that very easily. The central bank should have appreciated that, but they didn't for whatever sets of reasons. So here we are. And, you know, that Forbes article touched on a really important point, which is that it's not just the United States that's shoveling untold trillions of new debt dollars into the system, but many other countries are as well. All of Europe is performing the same task, and Japan certainly, and China has been undergoing a lot of stimulus of its own, and maybe it's going to have a crisis someday soon, too. And you know what? This is just the nature of the kind of debt-based system that we've got. It goes through these periodic bouts. And the thing that I really, really wish our leaders had appreciated early on is that the larger the debt bubble grows, the further you perpetuate it and allow it to continue, the worse the crisis that comes associated with it. And that's easy to appreciate, and history is absolutely full of that particular cautionary tale. And that's the thing that when I do get annoyed about this, I go, why didn't, you know, how is it possible that I'm a guy, I sit in my office in Massachusetts, and I read all this publicly available information, and I can connect those dots, and many other people did as well. But none of us were actually in the halls of power. None of us had a seat at the table. None of us were invited to share our points of view with the power makers out there in Washington, D.C. and in New York. And so we got into this crisis, and it is my absolute clear view at this point that you cannot solve a crisis rooted in too much debt by going deeper into debt. It's that simple to me. I don't see any way around this besides either paying those debts back, which means we have to get our productive economy growing again, which means you have to invest in your economy, things we're not doing. It's not clear to me that our economy can actually grow organically with this level of debt that's still sitting out there to pay it off productively. So then your other opportunity is to default on those debts. And that's really what we should be doing. You know, we should take Citibank, and they made horrible decisions, and you know, I feel very bad for all the bondholders who invested in them, but better luck next time. Oh, don't forget to do your due diligence and not to invest in companies that are reckless like that. But we didn't do that. We preserved all the bondholders of Citi by bailing Citi out, and in the bailing out, we didn't make the debts go away. We just transferred them. We transferred them from one owner to another, from a private to a public source. And so my view is that if we started at $26 trillion in debt in 2000 and we ramped that up to $52 trillion, like all good bubbles, when this one bursts, the way to fix it, which is painful, is to run that bubble back down from where it started. It has to go back to where it started from, which means we have about $26 trillion of debt destruction that we're going to have to sort of figure out how to accommodate. And we've gone through, I don't know, maybe a couple trillion of that at this point, potentially. So, you know, in my view, we've got a long way to go. But that's, you know, taking a strict sort of a debt-based view on this.
Yeah, it's well put, Chris. And in that article I was looking at today, they were really even, and I think we're referring to Carmen Reinhart and Kenneth Rogoff, Carmen at University of Maryland, Kenneth at Harvard, and they were reflecting to their studies and some of the work they've got in their book. This time it's different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly. They were talking about a tipping point, too, that 90% or the 90% ratio of government debt to GDP is a tipping point. Where are we? Aren't we close? Are we in the 80s someplace on this? And then is that a relevant thing to keep in our mind relative to a tipping point, or do you think we're already past that tipping point?
Well, it's kind of a tricky number because we have two types of government debt. One is what's called public debt, which absolutely has to be paid back. What's that? Maybe, I don't know, $7 trillion right now?
Mm-hmm.
So that's sitting at about 50% of GDP. And then we have this stuff called intergovernmental holdings, fancy word for money that the government has borrowed from itself. Try doing that in your own life. And that represents money that's been lifted out of the entitlement programs, notably Social Security. And that's another $5 trillion or so. You put both of those together, because those collectively really are the debts of the United States government, and those come to about $12 trillion. So, yeah, it's about 80-some percent. That concerns me, but the one that concerns me more is looking at the fiscal deficit. So debt is debt. The deficit is the difference between how much money the government takes in and expends on a yearly basis or monthly, however we're measuring it. That number, when we look at last year, 2009, the government spent 40% more money than it took in, a little bit more than 40%. So we ran a 40% deficit number, and that's a number that historically for any other country has been a very clear, bright red line. Once you cross it, you end up with a fiscal crisis, if not a monetary crisis. And we're not only going to run that 40% last year for 2009, it looks like we're going to run it for 2010 as well, or something very close to it. So we'll have 2 years of a 40% deficit figure there, and that's a really concerning number for me more immediately.
Wow, that's a good clarification, Chris. But the workaround, and the government's really talking about we can make through this because we're going to grow our way out of it. And as I've seen some of the assumptions that the budget office and so forth, it looks like it's at least 3 or 4%. I mean, isn't it more like 4% what the assumptions are based on going forward? I mean, in a realm that doesn't even seem realistic, as you're describing.
Well, you know, unless we have a serious bout of inflation, we're not going to grow our way out of this. And inflation would just make it look like we're growing our way out of it. Really, that would just essentially be taking wealth away from the people who had been our creditors. So leave inflation off the table for a moment. Just imagine that we're going to grow our way out of this, and let's test that. When Bush II took office, I think our total collective deficit was in the vicinity of total collective. This is everything. This includes all the entitlement program lapses and fully accruing for everything that we might owe at the federal government level. It was probably in the vicinity of around $20, $22 trillion total. That was the total government debt and liabilities. And when he left office, it was around $53, $55 trillion, depending on who's counting at the time. So it doubled. And during that entire period of time, we had growth, right? We had pretty reasonable growth. And so that really sort of puts a hole in the story that we can grow our way out of these problems, because the deficits and the debts are actually growing faster than the growth itself. Even when we were experiencing good, solid 3, 4, even 5% growth in some of those quarters, it didn't matter. As fast as that growth happened, the underlying debts and liabilities were growing and accumulating faster. And, you know, the story that's lurking in plain sight here, and David Walker has just written a great new book called Come Back America. He's a former comptroller of the U.S., and he's really just got his finger thoroughly on the pulse of this. You know, he was in all the high-level meetings, and he writes from a position of extreme authority and expertise on this. And he points out that the way in which the United States government accounts for its true fiscal state would land any corporation in jail. It's absolutely a fictitious sort of an accounting. So when we put the true accounting in there and we look at it, we find that the situation is not one that we've proven yet that we can actually grow out of.
So what you're pointing to me, Chris, is a picture of contraction of sorts, some expectation to that. We have a huge bubble that has to come back. I'd like to get some of your opinions about where you see this heading, near-term and longer-term, giving some of this picture. Last segment, Chris Martinson, come on back with us in a minute. We'll take a short break. You're on Zoomed. I'm John Schmidt. come back in a moment for the last. Thanks.
Up-to-date business and financial news. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790.
The experts are here.
Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership. Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8888. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
The Marsh Engel Show. Join the movement to empower yourself with the essentials of feminine power and success, and learn how women around the world are becoming more inspired, more influential, and absolutely amazing. Each week, Marsh sits down for an engaging conversation with women who are boldly committed to living their most amazing life. You'll discover ways to step into your greatest vision, deepen your relationships, and unleash your real creative brilliance. Get ready. It's time to jump into the conversation. That's Monday afternoons at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern for the Marsh Engel Show on the Voice America Business Network.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Zoom Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, last segment here with Chris Martinson, 3 E's, the new decade of awareness. Perhaps, Chris, we can pull this together in a way to build upon perhaps the implications that we're describing out of not being able to grow our way out of this, out of having limitations in energy. What are we likely to face coming forward? And then let's close with some picture, some larger view of where we started, which is how can we wrap this together, thinking about the ideas that really need reshaping, the vision on the horizon. But let's get there. What's your sense? What are we looking at more near term? What are some of the contractions, the feeling of where we're going to be?
Well, you know, I think that if to summarize the last segment, it's really my view that we're not out of the woods yet. And I truly believe that the more time we spend as a nation, maybe as globally, the more time we spend sort of denying the reality of what just happened. That, you know, I think we should just have a nice, calm conversation with ourselves, maybe like that, you know, kind talk from your uncle. You know, get the arm around the shoulder and it says, look, you overdid it. You might have just, you have to admit, you went too far with the whole debt thing. And that the lifestyle that came associated with that debt was an illusion because you were living beyond your means. And now we're going to have to live below our means for a while. Sorry, you know, it's that the party's over talk from the uncle, right? And so if we could just start from that position and say, okay, whew, you know, we don't have to expend trillions of dollars desperately trying to reinflate that prior thing because that prior thing isn't even worth recreating. It was fictitious. And so I would just really, my hope at this point is that we can start to have the adult conversation that says, okay, we did that. Maybe that was a mistake. Okay, let's not cast any blame because here we are, but what do we do now? And if we did that, you know, we have an exciting opportunity here to take these same trillions of dollars, but reapply them in ways that actually do something tangible, concrete for our country that will start to tell have a new narrative associated with it that people can believe in. You know, I'm looking across. I'm a hack political observer, but you know, and I've watched the media try and understand why Scott Brown won in Massachusetts, my home state, and I think they're missing it. I think what they're missing is that if that was a referendum on anything, it wasn't necessarily Obama, it wasn't this or that. I think it was really a referendum on we just don't want things to keep going in the direction they're going. And was it a crude club to pull out? Yes, but we only had two to choose from, Martha Coakley or Scott Brown. And so, you know, that's the way I read it. I read, and in my work, I encounter people all the time who fundamentally say, we're just headed in the wrong direction. And it's not a question of should we put a few extra dollars in the healthcare plan or a few less. It's just it's fundamentally off track completely from where we want to go. So if we could take those same trillions and put them into a story that people could really get behind because they would understand it, because it would make sense, because they could look at it and it would jive with what they were reading and what they understood about the world, either intellectually or intuitively. And that stuff for me would be very simply making adult-sized investments back into our education in this country. You know, if we want to face a couple facts, the United States scores very poorly relative to other countries out there, particularly in science, particularly in engineering, particularly in places where we know the challenges of the future lie. So maybe we could reinvest in that. And along the way, wouldn't it be nice to get ourselves a really nice high-speed electrified rail transport system? And wouldn't it be nice to upgrade our electric grid and all these things that everybody I'm talking to, I haven't run into anybody who's ever said, those are bad ideas, Chris. I just couldn't get behind that. We'd all be behind it. And so we have this mystery where we know that politics is supposed to be about meeting the will of the people. The people are overwhelmingly for things that don't happen and overwhelmingly against other things that do happen. And that's where the cynicism crops up. And that's the part, you know, I'm trying so hard to correct in my own life and in the words that I use elsewhere, because we need to close this gap between what we know we need to do and what we're actually doing. And it's a pretty profound gap right now. And so that's sort of the structure against which I view at least partly the outcome of that most recent election in Massachusetts, is that people understand that there's real serious challenges, and we haven't started to have a serious dialogue about them yet. We're still trying to pretend, somewhat like an adolescent, that, you know, we didn't dent the car, but it's dented and it's in the garage, and, you know, we're going to have to deal with it sooner or later. So, how do we get there?
Yeah, this sounds to me a lot like, Chris, that it's the old system, the old world, and it's really waking up to re-architecting, redesigning, reframing, reshaping, looking at it fundamentally anew with fresh ideas and the way we spend our money and how we devote our time and energy and realize life. I mean, is that part of what you're pointing to?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, I'll be honest, there's a very sort of a grim picture that I see, and that picture is painted by the defenders of the status quo winning and successfully just continuing to do the same things that we just proved don't work, shoveling more good money after bad that's already destroyed, and continuing to push us down a path of returning to a type of consumptive lifestyle that frankly appears broken when we look at it in the context of where we are in the world at this point in time. That's a grim picture. So when I talk to people who really devoutly defend the status quo, I really see them as sort of the people who are actively working to deliver a much poorer, more destitute future to me and my children and everybody else, whereas there are a whole number of people out there who are waking up, who've decided that they're not going to wait for the power structure, for D.C., for the media to finally get it and deliver the right story. They're remaking the story right now in their communities and in how they live their lives today. And that's happening just, it's all over the place, but it's just startling to see the difference between what conclusions individuals and small communities have come to compared to the conclusions that are still being derived in Washington, D.C.
Chris, that's really well put, and I know that's part of the other side of the PCI, Post-Carbon Institute, is about the transitions in local communities and the energy that's there. I'll also suggest that in a couple of weeks, John Peterson's coming on our show to talk about, I think, the vision you're pointing to and how do we and how might we collectively even do that at more of the societal level that builds upon even some of the more technology underpinnings. How do we connect people even more globally using the Internet and others to be able to do that? I think there's some ideas about it, but your point, Chris, about the local community and connecting, it's encouraging to hear what you're saying, though, that people are, in fact, beginning to get the message on that.
Well, it's absolutely the case, and the thing that's even more encouraging is that I feel the speed of that picking up. And I think, you know, one of the things I really hold true is that, you know, this does represent a change to the status quo, and I worked in big corporations, so I understand the inertia, the cultural inertia and other forms that exist in a fairly large institution. And, you know, our country is a giant institution, so I fully understand why there could be some time between the status quo really changing and getting it and when individuals start to change. And so, guess what? People are changing, they're waking up, and where people's minds go, politics eventually follows.
And that's right, Chris. And I really want to say that's where I was coming from with the decade of awareness. People are waking up. That's part of what you have collectively been doing. We're trying to do on Zoomed. Chris, I know I hear the music in my ears. We're going to need to begin to transition here. But I want to say thanks again for joining us. Love to have your perspective on it. Really great reports all around. Thanks, Chris.
All right. Thank you, John.
Again, Chris Martinson here, chrismartinson.com, The Crash Course. Take a look. I think he's connecting the dots in wonderful ways. This is the Zoomed conversation. Chris, I think, put it well, framing the vision for the future. Join us next week. Erica Allen comes in. She's the Chicago Projects Manager for Growing Power. Our subject, food. Our subject, urban farming. Our subject, social justice. It's part of this community conversation about enabling, empowering, grasping, pulling together the sovereignty that we can to create the vision for the future, the new ideas that Chris is describing. That's where we're going. Further conversation. Thanks again, Chris. Love to have you on the show all the time if we can, but today, as always, crisp and clear picture. John Schmidt out for the week. Enjoy. Keep up the good work. Talk to you again soon. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you again for listening to Zoomed Leadership with host John Schmidt. Please be sure to join us again next Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. And have a terrific week.